Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Ever heard of news avoidance? Well, recent studies say almost 30% of people worldwide sometimes or often avoid the news. In the U.S., it's closer to 40%. People turn off the TV, the radio, they try to run away from the tentacles of bad news reaching up at you through your smartphone. Distrust is a big part of the problem, but mostly it turns out the news makes people depressed and emotionally exhausted. And yes, I am aware that we play a role in this too, but that is why we also want to look for solutions. So this hour on Point, why so many people are avoiding the news. And you can join us. Have you sat down to watch the news or turned off the TV halfway through that first story? Are you switching to music or podcasts when you drive? And have news organizations been grinding people down in the name of profit? And yes, I want to say, obviously, this is a news program. We are journalists here, too. So if you want to say, hey, On Point, you're part of the problem, I will hear that. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us in the studio today is Joshua Benton. He's founder and director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. He recently published a piece on this phenomenon of news avoidance on the Nieman Lab Journal. And you can find a link to his article at onpointradio.org. Joshua, it's great to have you.
Great to be here.
First of all, let's give people a taste, maybe whether they want it or not, of kind of just the tumult that is in the air regarding the news. And so cable news anchors, as we know, back in the day, it seemed like they used to introduce reports from around the country and around the world. Now a lot of cable is just marked by argument, and the anchors themselves take part in it. So we made a little montage to give people a sense of that sound, and here it is.
Brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
And that's what happens when a 21,000-pound bomb explodes in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, where at least 36 ISIS fighters have lost their life.
There's outrage on the left, and they have Trump derangement syndrome, and they're always out to look without ever addressing the substance.
They're not about facts, they're about feelings.
But then their audience just eats it up. Yeah, that's right!
I didn't even think you needed braces.
I didn't either, honestly.
Yeah, seriously.
It's my bite. It's bad.
Is it? Yeah, well, now it's your lisp.
Okay. So.
Just saying.
So tell me about the focus.
So,
group.
Yeah,
how's your focus?
So you heard their hosts from Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN. All right. So Joshua Benton, is news avoidance, is this why people are avoiding the news?
You know, I think it's less the jokes about braces and lisp than probably just the general tenor of a lot of the news that we've been seeing. You know, this has been a problem for a long time. The news for decades and decades has been built on conflict. You know, something bad happens, that's a story. Something good happens, it isn't. So for a long time, news organizations have been criticized for pumping in negativity and using that as a model to keep people coming back, reading the paper or watching the show. I think with the election of Donald Trump, though, it has really accelerated. And we've seen a lot of people feel that on one hand, they feel an enormous obligation to follow the news, keep track of everything that's going on. But at the same time, they feel exhausted by it. And a lot of them are choosing to just check out.
So I think the negativity in the news, as you rightly point out, has been going on for a long time. That fear consumption cycle is pretty powerful. But in addition to the election of the president, don't we have the confluence of a number of factors? We have a highly polarizing figure in the White House. We have the ubiquity of 24/7 cable news. We have technology on top of that. So, you know, even if you want, unless you turn off every notification on your phone and you never look at social media, it can be virtually impossible unless you are asleep to escape the bombardment of the news.
Exactly. I mean, one thing that was true about the pre-internet version of news consumption was that it was very habit-driven. You sat down in the morning and read the newspaper at your breakfast table. You sat down at 6 o'clock to watch a TV show. You listened to NPR on your drive to or from work. It was a certain part of the day that was set aside for news consumption. Now, with our phones in our pockets, the news sort of comes to find us all day long, 24/7. It's hard to get a respite if you're the kind of person who's checked in to push notifications, who has websites that you want to check out, who gets, you know, email news alerts, that sort of thing. One thing that has changed, though, is that means that the people who like me, perhaps like you, perhaps like a lot of people listening, who are really interested in news can now get more of it than ever before. Mm-hmm. You can consume news all day long. But there are other people who don't particularly like consuming news, and they now have many more options that are not news, right? If when I was growing up, if it was 6 o'clock and you wanted to watch something on TV, you were going to be watching the news because that's all that was on. If you wanted to get find out how the Red Sox did last night, you were going to have to buy the newspaper to get the box score, and there's going to be news put in front of you. Now it's really pretty easy to just be distracted by whatever's on your news feed in Facebook or whatever game you're playing on your phone.
Yeah. So how surprised were you? I mean, this has been happening for a couple of years, but how surprised were you that the numbers of people reporting news avoidance are as high as they are? I mean, almost 40% in the United States, according to some polls?
Yeah, the digital news report that came out earlier this month, 41% in the United States, up 3% from 2 years ago. I guess I'm not surprised in one sense that it certainly is fit with the anecdotal evidence that I've heard. There are people who used to consume a lot of news who feel for their own emotional health they need to step back, and other people who just feel like there's too much and it's not worth trying to make the effort. You saw a much larger increase over the last 2 years in the UK because of, you know, the Brexit phenomenon. Mm-hmm. A lot of people there say, I don't get anything in return for my investment of time in consuming news.
Well, we're getting a lot of comments on this already. Allison Fink says, I consume a lot of news and I'm starting to avoid it a bit because I just feel so utterly powerless in the face of it all, which doesn't help me or anyone else. So let's talk a little bit more about this because the sheer volume of it, we can discuss, but it's the underlying reason why people are avoiding it that I think is worthy of more exploration, because this is a common refrain.
Like, right, right.
It's so negative. It's so overwhelming. And there's nothing I can do about it.
And as part of this, the survey that I mentioned from a couple weeks ago, they asked people who are news avoiders why they avoid the news. And the number one answer in the United States, 57% said it's because it has a negative impact on my mood. It makes me sad. It makes me depressed, whatever it may be. Only 35% was because they said that they couldn't trust the news. They felt that they couldn't rely on its accuracy. And that's a very ideologically split phenomenon. Liberals are much more likely to say that it's the negative effect on their mood. Conservatives are much more likely to say that they can't trust the media. And, you know, I think people are rational economic actors. They have time. They work hard. They have a lot of things they need to do. They're raising kids. They're doing whatever it is they're doing. And those of us who like the news and enjoy the news and are, you know, like to produce and consume the news, we can sometimes have high expectations for people who have a lot of other things they'd rather do with their day. And people are, you know, voting with their thumbs, you might say.
But isn't this one of the exact parts of the major problem here is that, okay, so there's a lot of competition for people's attention. Like, this is the attention economy. And for their time, which is the one thing that they can never get back. So in that fierce competition, it's actually driving the news and the approach to the news towards even greater negativity, towards even greater sensationalism, which are exactly the things that people are saying are driving them away from the news.
Exactly. When you think back to that time of before the internet, when you had fewer choices, it made sense from a business perspective to be pretty middle of the road. There are only three news shows in your city or national news network shows. It made sense for everyone to be pretty mainstream, not be the extreme liberal show or the extreme conservative show or whatever it may be. When you moved first to cable news and then you move to digital, suddenly there's an incentive to not be in the middle and to chase one particular niche audience, to be very conservative, to be very liberal. There aren't many new news sites coming about that don't have an ideological point of view. That's the way you go chase an audience. And in that, I think one of the big lessons, and this is particularly true on social media and in particular Facebook, is that people have realized that what gets people to share information on Facebook is emotion. It's things that make people very angry, things that people make make people very happy. Something that is not going to – a regular old story about this is a thing that happened at city council today, that's death on Facebook. It's not going to go anywhere. But if you can have a narrative where someone is the clear villain or the clear victim, that emotionally charged material really resonates. And I think when you – in the shift to digital, we've seen news organizations incentivized to create more of that content, which maybe pleases some part of our lizard brain that wants to have these clear-cut narratives, but at the same time also contributes to the sense like, oh, my God, it never ends.
Right. So I want to underscore something that you mentioned a little earlier. This is happening worldwide, right? I mean, even in places I was noticing from your article, like apparently Japan is a very it's a culture of extreme news consumers. But even there, we've seen an uptick of people avoiding the news, although much less of one. But this is a global phenomenon.
It is a global phenomenon, yeah. I think it lines up with I think you'd probably draw a connection to the global rise in populism that has created a more a harsher toned political environment in a number of countries. That's probably a piece of it. But I really think a lot of it is technology. It's a lot easier to avoid the news. I mean, if you had a job 30 years ago in the break room, there was probably a newspaper sitting there that you could go and sit about. We used the news that we all consumed on the front page of the newspaper, on the TV news, as a social lubricant that gave us something to talk to each other about. Now there are a lot of other things that are filling those same sorts of needs. And the pieces of the job that a newspaper did or the job that a TV newscast did, a lot of those things are now being done by other apps, by other phenomena. I mean, you don't need to go – if you want to get the sports score, you don't have to go to a newspaper website anymore. If you want to get the weather, you don't have to watch the TV news. And what's left is a product that is a little bit more – a little harsher, is focusing on harsher realities and rubs some people the wrong way.
Well, we've got, again, lots of comments coming in on this. Jim McLucky says, news is becoming less and less valuable to the end user. Well, I want to explore that to you, the mm-hmm. question of what value news is actually bringing to people's lives. But Jim says, less valuable to the end user and more valuable to the advertisers. This trend has been going on for decades, and social media has only made it worse. It's all op-ed and outrage. So we are talking this hour about the growing phenomenon of news avoidance. Do you turn the TV off, the radio off, although I hope you don't do that right now? Do you ignore those push notifications on your phone because it's all just too much? And how do we bring greater value to your lives? How does journalism actually enrich your life? What more should we be doing to get to that goal? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the growing phenomenon of news avoidance. A little more than 40% of Americans in a recent survey said they avoid the news because it's too much, it's too depressing, they can't trust it, and it doesn't add value to their lives. Are you one of them? Let's listen to a little bit of the tone and the approach that might be driving people away. Here's a moment from CNN's State of the Union, where host Jake Tapper and White House senior advisor Stephen Miller get into a bit of a tussle.
Look, you can be as condescending as you want. It's part of your MO. But listen, you can have 24/7.
I have no idea why
you
you're attacking
have,
me.
Well, I'll explain to you.
My point
I'll tell you why I'm attacking
Steve Bannon,
you.
Steve Bannon,
Jake, you can have a
24/7. Helped push the president's travel ban.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Because one of the fake news items in the book.
Steven.
I would happen to know better than you would, Jake, about how the travel ban was written.
So that's Jake Tapper and White House advisor Stephen Miller on CNN. Joshua Benton joins us this hour. He's founder and director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University, and he wrote recently about this issue of or phenomenon of news avoidance. And Joshua, let me ask you, on the one hand, you know, I hear Jake Tapper there journalistically trying to stand his ground in a conversation with a White House advisor who has a very particular point of view. Like that's I can hear that in what Tapper's trying to do. But on the other hand, it's very argumentative. And I'm not sure this is the question of what value are interactions like this actually adding to people's lives? How is it deepening the understanding of the core issues that that these two gentlemen were ostensibly supposed to be discussing? I mean, isn't that part of the problem here?
Right. I mean, Jay Rosen at NYU has a saying where that the news business is not necessarily in the business of creating information or creating informed citizen. They're in the business of creating news, right? It's an output-driven business. I would suspect that after that exchange, there was some share of the CNN audience that said, "Ugh, why am I watching these people arguing?" But there's probably another share that said, "Yeah, go get them, Jake." You know, they want that sort of argumentative approach. Part of the issue is that the audience for things like cable news they're really small. You know, on the daytime slot at CNN, there are going to be less than a million people watching every day. Of that, if you look at the number of people who are in the sort of advertiser-friendly slot, 18 to 54, it's going to be significantly smaller, maybe a couple hundred thousand. The people who are watching cable news are people who are unusually dedicated to the battle of politics. And this is one of the issues that I think is really problematic, is that when we go from having a mass media that for all of its problems was trying to be appealing to everybody, CBS, ABC, NBC, they didn't say they were only want this slice of the market. They wanted as much of the market as they could. When you go to a narrower niche audience, such as what you see on cable news, the incentive is to try and please these people who have very unusual interests. Uh-huh. They want to consume lots of news. They want to see the conflict. They would probably be very mad if Jake Tapper wasn't going after Stephen Miller in that
sort of
way.
I may, interest and conflict don't have to be the same thing, right? I mean, because you can imagine a world where with these niche audiences, because they are so engaged on particular topics, that they might end up being, through the journalism that they're consuming, the most informed people, you know, in the country about these issues. But that's not what's happening.
Yeah, there's one thing that is, I think, difficult for a lot of journalists to get is we've always thought that the answer is we need to inform the public and the public will make wiser decisions. In reality, there's a very strong correlation between having more informed members of the public and having more politically ideological members of the public. If you look at people who, you know, if you give them a standard test of political knowledge, what's the name a Supreme Court justice, what party controls the House, just basic facts. People who don't do well on that, who aren't very informed on the news, are going to have very middle-of-the-road opinions. The people who get, you know, a perfect score on those tests, they're very likely to be far on the left or far on the right. Which makes sense. They've thought about these issues. They've consumed a lot of news. It makes total sense they would have come to some conclusion. But that means that when you're appealing to that audience, you're necessarily driving the news in a direction that is excluding a big part of the middle of the U.S.
Yeah, I have to say this is a question that I am personally obsessed with. How are we, period, just adding value in the information that we're trying to present to audiences? And it becomes an increasingly difficult question to answer, I would say. But look, we've got comments coming in from people who are saying it's not just cable news. For example, Mike L. says, "I rarely watch the local evening news." Mike says it reports on local government events as if reading from a press release, never questioning expenditure or decisions. It reports the weather as if directly addressing tourists in their hotel rooms, and it reports on crime as though it's only happening in one part of town where they park their news van 24/7. Even the intro of their show, Mike puts in quotes, Sounds like I'm being sold a new car.
I mean, local TV news is the number one source of local news for Americans. It was only last year passed by the internet as the number one source of news for Americans, period. It has a big regular audience. And, you know, as a former newspaper person, I look at that and say, I'm not sure they're providing the best product. But again, if you can see over time from the news that I remember growing up, a larger and larger emphasis on entertainment. If you look at local TV news in a lot of markets, you'll see, you know, 15 clips of the things that a producer found on Instagram that they thought were funny and going viral, and that's what fills time. And mix that in with crime and a few other things that are going to get people's, passions firing. And it's not a great product, but it's a product that a lot of people use as their only way of connecting to public affairs and the civic life at all.
So the impact on democracy and civic life, we're going to talk about more in just a second, Joshua. But let me let some callers in. Jack is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm in the category that lost interest in the news, so-called in quotes, because I don't trust the fake news of the corporate media in this country, which at this point now is trying to project its own fakery clear across the world to Russia. And I think this is the reason that I see this total uniformity of the corporate big business media, which even congressional committees some years ago when they had some honest congressmen documented that is completely infiltrated by the CIA, which lies us into these wars around the world. And my mood is angry at the lies we've been told. Ever since the Gulf of Tonkin, when anyone who questioned it at the time, before it could have saved millions of lives being bombed to death in Vietnam, were told they were conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
It only came out much later that we realized that this was a false flag frame-up.
Right.
And these types of things, I think, if you just look up Gladio Crimes of the U.S., you'll see links to these kinds of false flag frame-ups that are never mentioned by our media that act as a kind of a stenographer for any of the lies that the government lies us into these wars for.
Jack, thank you so much for your call. Joshua, let me just get your quick take on what Jack's saying. I mean, he's reflecting the opinion that the media just parrots what the government wants it to say.
Well, I don't know if the Trump administration would say that the media parrots what – at least much of the media parrots what he wants them to say. I would say this, that if you look at trust in the media, if you look back at Gallup survey numbers from the 1970s, the early 70s, trust was at 70-80%.
It's almost unimaginable.
Now
today,
it is much more like 30% or so. And it's a very ideologically split divide. Democrats trust the media more than people in Sweden and Norway and the most trustworthy the places which have the highest levels of trust in the world, whereas conservatives have lower levels of trust than any other country in the world if they were their own nation. It's a huge divide, and a lot of it's motivated by, a president who likes to say everything is fake news. It's not.
Well, let's bring in another voice into the conversation. Candy Crowley joins us now. She's with us from Glen Arbor Township, Michigan. She's a former CNN chief political correspondent, former host of CNN's Sunday show, State of the Union. Now she is an author and also a Quartz pro with the online journal Quartz. Now, she's one of a group of experts who help lead users through the news of the day by selecting important articles and adding those and adding commentary as well. So, Candy Crowley, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. You can also put down there a sometimes news avoider.
Sometimes news avoider from a news legend such as yourself. Why?
Well, I'm still a news junkie, okay? And that's the honest-to-God truth about it. Except for that I have to say, and I'm among those who think it's important to know what's going on in the world or what, and I go to various sources for it, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes it just feels like eating eggplant. I just can't do it because it becomes too much. I've heard this from people, sort of day to day, who will stop me and say, "What do you think of this? What do you think of that?" Well, I don't listen anymore, and it's that they think it all seems like the same story now. It's every story has the same rhythm, whether it be a story about a mass shooting or a story about the budget or a story about even U.S. relations with Iran. It seems to them that it's the same story that keeps coming around and they're hearing the same things. And, as you mentioned before, they have a hard time relating it to anything they have power over to change.
How much would you hold your own former network to account for this?
I think as much as anybody else, absolutely. But I will just add this, that I also have to blame the reading public, the viewing public, the listening public, because when news became, and this goes way back, and you've heard this argument before, but when news became a profit center, it has to produce what people will see, will watch, will listen to. Otherwise, you don't have a news department. You don't have a local news department if people aren't watching the local news. You get something else in its place or a different news group that's going to go after things that people want to watch, whether it's a car wreck or squirrels nursing chipmunks or whatever happens to be is something that's eye candy on TV or clickbait on the Internet. So I think that there is obligation all around, and we can – news avoidance may be it. I mean, if you watch your audience drop, you change what's going on. I think it has to be a bigger drop than talked about at Neiman, but that they found. But I think that there is a consumer responsibility – also, and not responsibility, but a consumer input to this, that the news would change if people wanted something different.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing that your comment brings up for me, which is that one of the underrated factors here is that we've increasingly moved from a world where local news is dominant to a world where national news is dominant.
Right.
I mean, local newspapers were the only path to, a certain kind of news for people for a very long time. Same with local television. If you wanted, you were watching a local television broadcast if you wanted to get news. And local news is the kind of news that people trust the most. It is where people feel a real connection to the reporter, to the anchor. These are people who are in their community, who seem to be interested in the needs of their community. Whereas it's very easy if you're from Michigan, like Candy, or Louisiana, like I am, to see a national broadcast or to read the New York Times or the Washington Post and see it as something very distant. And as technology distribution technology has made life much worse for local media, it's a lot harder to make money in the local newspaper business, as we know, than it used to be, and really pushed forward these national and international brands. I think that's one reason why people feel that distance.
Yeah. Candy, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but there are so many people who have views on this. I just want to get our listeners in here. So let's go to Catherine, who's calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi. Just wanted to say news has always been very important in my family. My dad watched Watergate while we played on the beach. But I am very concerned at where it's going with too much opinion, watching a news show with people smirking, rolling their eyes, telling jokes, cynicism. That is not journalism. And that is scary to me, and it's frustrating and disappointing. I want the facts. I want to hear both sides, and then I want to be able to make my own opinions. And otherwise, I have to turn the channel, and news is important to me. So I end up with a 30-minute show and hope it ends on a good note. That's a great thing to happen. But I am frustrated, and I think it's the 24/7 thing.
Right.
I think they just got to find a way to fill the hours. And
Catherine, thank you so much for your call. And actually, Candy Crowley, let me turn to you on something specific that Catherine said about the smirking and the rolling of the eyes. I mean, we've seen, on CNN's website occasionally, like the top news on the website isn't necessarily the interview that's happened or the news that they're covering, but an anchor's, facial responses. Is that a problem?
I think it's a problem. I'm not a fan of that. I was thinking, listening to Jake, who is a terrific journalist, and I didn't hear the whole, I didn't see that show, so I don't know what the whole thing was like, just that little snippet that you played. And I thought what I might have done differently is I wouldn't have bitten on the personal slam from the White House guy who said, well, I know that you're condescending and that's your way. I wouldn't have come back and said, well, I don't know why you're attacking me. I'd have just kept on the question. Because, and here's why. And again, I didn't hear the whole thing, so this is not a criticism of Jake. It's from that little snippet.
Yeah.
And I just feel as though the minute that we have started, it started to be about journalists somewhere along the line, instead of the news. Well, what does so-and-so think of this, you know, this anchor? What does, oh, I know so-and-so, he's the, you know, the husband of so-and-so. And they, and more, there's this sort of participatory journalism where journalists kind of got in the story. And I think that's dangerous, but it made people connect with the journalist. And I think that's why it was, you know, we were often encouraged to not to be a part of the story, but to be, you know, involved in a way that made people understand what your reactions were. And I think that's, I think it's not good because I think it makes it about the journalist and it should be about the news. But I'm old fashioned.
Old is old fashioned doesn't mean it's bad, Candy. Joshua, let me turn back to you. We've got a minute and a half before the break here. And there is, I want to turn the discussion just momentarily to a question that dominates my mind a lot. News avoidance, as it grows, I mean, what potential impact can that have on democracy, civic engagement, as you talked about earlier? I mean, is that a concern?
It's a real concern for me, in part because news avoidance is not a randomly distributed among the American population or the global population. Consistently, you see that liberals are consuming far more news than conservatives are. You see that people with college degrees are consuming much more news than people who don't have college degrees are. You are seeing this unusually educated, unusually liberal, unusually upmarket, you know, pretty good salary group of people who are infovores, who consume an enormous amount of information. And you see an enormous gap going with everyone else. I like to think about, imagine a city 30 years ago, and imagine you ranged everyone in the city from the most informed person to the least informed person. Now look at, say, the 90th percentile and the 10th percentile. Now, yes, the 90th percentile person is more informed, but both those people have the same newspaper to read. They have the same TV newscast to watch every night. They're living in the same information universe. Right now, that's not the case anymore. That guy, the 90th percentile, has curated Twitter feeds and gets all the right email newsletters. And that guy at the 10th percentile, he's just playing Candy Crush.
Well, we are talking about news avoidance and the growing phenomenon of people turning away from the news. When we come back, we'll talk about how we might change that. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the growing number of people who are avoiding the news because it's too much, it's too depressing, too disempowering. Maybe they don't trust the news. But what effect, what impact is increasing news avoidance having on democracy and on civic engagement? Joshua Benton joins us this hour. He's founder and director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University, and he recently published a piece on the phenomenon of news avoidance. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Candy Crowley is with us as well. She's a former CNN chief political correspondent, former host of CNN's Sunday show State of the Union. Now she's an author and also a Quartz pro with the online journal Quartz. We'll talk about what that is in a couple of minutes. And Candy's got a forthcoming novel coming out as well called Certain. And let's go back to the phones. Carla is joining us from Winter Haven, Florida. Carla, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I have definitely been having a battle trying to re-engage back into the news. As someone who had to go through the whole citizenship process, up until like a few months ago, I got my citizenship. So like I was in a state where I didn't know. I knew that I had to engage in the news because it was very important for me to know what was going on, especially with the immigration. But now that I've become a citizen, there's been this big weight lifted off of me And so I kind of feel like I've been loosely, like, slowly disengaging from the news because it's been very sad and been very difficult to watch. It just seems very, like, dramatic, and I feel like I can't help. But I had an interesting experience yesterday watching the news about the children who were in the detention center. And on Twitter, it was very different. The replies to the news was more so to help. There were people who were raising money, who were trying to get engaged and trying to help these children out with either lawyer services or any kind of donation. So it made me re-engage back into that because I felt like I was able to help.
Yeah.
So,
well, Carla, thank you so much for your call. So Candy, let me turn to you first on this. Is that something that news and journalism ought to be considering more, how to re-engage people through offering solutions? Or is there a concern there that that tilts towards advocacy and not just straight journalism?
Well, I think it's a fine line there, and you're right. You have to watch out for that. I think some of that is already happening, and honestly, we can credit the internet and other arenas for that, because I think you will watch television news or listen to radio news and you will say, hey, if you want to know how you can help, go to our website. Of course, that drives people to their website, but we have a list of people who will help here and there. So I think that's already happening. I think that, however, the one thing I'll say is sometimes people wonder about how much help they can be. If you were around for Columbine 20 years ago, perhaps you decided, I'm going to join a Let's Get Better Mental Health into Schools, or I'm going to join a gun control group, or I'm going to donate here or there. And then 20 years later, you're watching the same thing play out every month. That's discouraging.
Yeah.
So I think it's the lack of that all things kind of dovetail, and so you see the lack of action is connected with the coverage that seems like the same thing over a couple of decades.
Yeah, I think that there's this movement towards solutions journalism and the idea that if you tell someone what the problem is, you should also tell them what some of the possible solutions are. And I think that there are some potential good impacts from that. They've had some good experiences. At the same time, though, I wonder about the extent to which people have the capacity to be asked to take action on every bad thing that comes along. I mean, as Candy, as you said, there's some things there you really can't. Helplessness is not necessarily a false impression. You might literally have no ability to impact a story in a really significant way. And I think there's a tension between saying, here's a terrible thing, do something about it, versus just here's a terrible thing, go home and stew.
Right. And there's a difference between solutions and relevance. To me, the news media should be more concentrated on the relevance of a story to its audience.
Right.
Not just, here's a story, but a kind of why it matters. There's some online people that are doing a great job at this. And I think there's people try, but sometimes I think, you know, people will watch something, listen to something, read something if they think it's relevant to their lives.
Right. Well,
so the relevance to me maybe is better than worrying about the solutions if you can, you know, or pointing people toward if they want to help, go here.
Well, so there's solutions in terms of actions that individuals can take. And then there's a kind of journalism that says, well, here are solutions that are going on in the community, right? And that's also worthy of news coverage as well. I mean, here's a quick example. This is from NPR member station WHYY, and Annette John Hall reported the story of a community-based program teaching defendants how to better defend themselves in court. So in this little clip, you're first going to hear Steve Austin, a former inmate who works as a facilitator for the program, and then you'll hear reporter Annette John Hall herself.
We encourage people to make sure that they have put together a package that allows them to present themselves as a whole person.
The package includes training defendants about the facts of their case, teaching them how to write a biography, obtaining letters of support, and identifying friends and loved ones who can come to court to vouch for them.
That's a report from member station WHYY. So we've been talking about solutions journalism. Let's introduce into the conversation for a couple of minutes Tina Rosenberg. She's co-founder of the Solutions Journalism Network. She's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist herself and co-authors the Fixes column for the New York Times Opinionator section. Tina Rosenberg, welcome to you.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what is solutions journalism?
Well, we have a very specific way of defining it, and it doesn't include telling people, here's how you can help. Our definition is closer to what you were talking about and Annette John Hall's report, and that is reporting with seriousness, not as fluff or cheerleading or advocacy, reporting on what people are doing to solve problems. And I think it gets to the point that Candy was raising about relevance. I mean, we're all worried about many different issues, but let's not just have reports that say how bad our schools are. Let's have reports that also look at a school in our district that has greatly raised its test scores or educational levels and look at how they did it. Every widely shared problem has lots of different people who've tried to solve it, and some of those responses are going to be more successful than others and worth reporting on. And we think that that should be a basic part of the definition of news.
And are the stories that embrace this model or this purpose, are they getting the same kind of traction that all the negative news that we've been talking about does?
They do. I mean, people want strong emotion, as you've been saying, but that emotion doesn't have to be outrage and anger and hate. It can be, hey, I feel excited about this. I feel empowered about this. Here's this problem that everybody is considered not solvable, and yet look at what the city has done to, you know, lower their infant mortality rate, or, you know, eliminate gang violence, or, you know, cure hunger. I mean, these things exist, and people like knowing about them. They like reading about them. There's a lot of research we have that people do engage with these stories. They spend a lot of time with them, and they're more likely to subscribe and stick with a news organization that has these kinds of stories.
And Tina, it seems to me that the very place that's most fertile for this kind of journalism are the places that Josh was telling us earlier have been suffering the most with news avoidance, and that's local news, don't you think?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, when we talk about journalism, we often talk as if cable news was all there was, and that's not the case. Local journalism is endangered, but it's still a huge force, and you know, a lot of local reporters are now starting to look at what's going on in our community that's working.
Yeah. Well, Joshua Benton, what do you think about solutions journalism as a potential way to address news avoidance?
I think it's an excellent tool for news organizations to have in their toolbox. It's not going to work on every story, but one thing that particularly local news organizations really need to do is make a much more affirmative case for why they're important, why their work is important. They could sort of rest on their laurels being the only game in town for a long time. Now people, particularly as news organizations shift from being paid poor by advertising to being asked, putting up paywalls, asking for subscriptions, in that shift, they really need to prove their worth. And I think being more engaged in offering solutions, encouraging solutions, creating community discourse around a particular issue is one really effective way to do that.
Well, let's go back to our phones. Scott is calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, I'll try to be brief. My first point is I devour the local newspaper and I focus on the local news because it is relevant and I can perhaps help affect a solution. The second point would be I think there's a phenomenon of, for most people, the news is chopped up into discrete bits and it doesn't have context. It doesn't allow for even consideration of solutions. And I think that one has to point to our president in his daily tweets. You know, when Lyndon Johnson was in office, he might give a speech every couple of weeks, and it just fractionalizes the news into these bursts of information that you feel just sort of bombarded by but powerless to put into context or do solutions.
Right.
Thanks.
Scott, thank you for your call. Josh, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I mean, I think Scott's right that one of the big problems is that we are engaging with news increasingly on digital platforms at the story level. We see a link on Twitter. We see a link on Facebook. We click through on it. When we had we were looking at print newspapers or broadcast, you're getting an edited product. Mm. Some editor was saying, well, these are the things that we think are important. These are the things that are maybe a little less important but very interesting. This is the lighthearted thing we're going to end the show with. That package was meant to communicate a relatively – comprehensive view of the world. Whereas if you're just clicking on random articles, you're going to be that part of your lizard brain that wants to see conflict, wants to get mad, wants to have some sort of emotional response is going to do it. And you're going to miss a lot of context.
Well, so Candy, this brings up our chance to talk about the new places where people are going for that edited content, right? Including, your Quartz Pro product that you helped put out, where you're essentially acting as an editor for a newsletter for people.
Right. And they have a much broader site, I will say, yeah, where they do, they have reporters that do news and all that. This is just a semi like Twitter in the sense that it's sort of brief remarks, but it's about the news. So they have, experts from all over the place. I learn a lot about business on this because they have a lot of CEOs that are sort of saying, okay, watch this, watch that. But you basically, if I see a story that I like that's political, that I think is significant, so I'll post that on Quartz and say, hey, this is, caught my eye because I don't believe the third graph, and I think that kind of thing. So it's sort of a brief comment and saying to people, this is an important political story, and try to sort of help them through the news. It's not the totality at all of what Quartz does, but it's sort of a part of it, and it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun because I like reading it because there's just interesting, people on it that scientists and this and that. And so they point out stories that I never would have read otherwise.
Well, Tina Rosenberg, it seems to me that there's the possibility, as always, that people essentially vote with their feet, even in this news context, right? Because we can turn to more curated newsletters. We can turn to the kind of journalism that you've been talking about with solutions journalism. Look, there's a big generational divide. What is it? More than 50% or more of people under the age of 35 regularly listen to podcasts, which are providing a very rich vein of journalism right now, pretty much unavailable anywhere else. So could those be the forces that sort of turn the news market, Tina?
That would be great, because what people, I think, really want and what they'll pay for, what is valuable to them, is real journalism about issues that matter. The shift in business model away from advertising has killed and is going to kill a lot of news organizations. But those that survive are going to survive because they are producing journalism that people want to pay for. And there's a lot of research to back up what Josh has been saying about negativity as by far the largest reason people disengage from the news. Consumers of news, especially young people, want to know about not just, they say, don't just tell me about the problems of the world. Tell me how people are solving them.
Mm. And Josh, if I want to just throw this to you, because for many, many years, the trend has been, in broadcast news, both on television and radio, for ever smaller chunks of information. But I do think podcasts are proving that people not only have a tolerance for, but a desire for a deep richness of information here. And I find that to be quite hopeful.
Yeah, I think that one thing that we have that has been shown to be wrong was the assumption and statement by a lot of people that the shift to digital meant that long-form content was going to die, whether that's a long New Yorker story or whether that's a long podcast. There is an appetite for that sort of thing. There is a sense in which people really enjoy stepping back from the digital deluge that they're getting on their phones and either listening to a different part of the world in their earphones or reading a long story. That's there. But it is, again, sort of a niche interest. There are people who are interested in that sort of content, but there's still a lot of people who are happy to go do something else.
Yeah. Candy, you just got to...
I think they haven't been offered anything different. I think people do respond when they know that there are alternatives, that we don't have to define what is news the way we've always defined it.
Right. And I think many people are pushing back against how the news is being defined. We had the caller earlier talking about the president's tweets. Is that news or not? I mean, that's a very important question. Candy Crowley, we just have 30 seconds left here to go. I just wanted to give you a chance to have a last thought. Do you think that news avoidance is a problem for civic engagement and for democracy?
Well, sure. I mean, I believe that news media is a vital part of a functioning democracy. So if people are tuning out, it's a problem. I don't think you have to have having solutions journalism be just journalism is kind of what the goal should be, I think, and to include in that, you got to tell the news, but you can also do some of these other things to make it, again, more relevant and less negative.
Well, Candy Crowley is former CNN chief political correspondent, former host of CNN's Sunday show State of the Union. She's now an author and a quartz pro, and author of the forthcoming novel Certain. Candy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Tina Rosenberg, co-founder of the Solutions Journalism Network and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, co-author of the Fixes column at the New York Times Opinionator section. Tina, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Joshua Benton, founder and director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. We've got a link to Josh's writing about news avoidance at onpointradio.org. It was great to have you in the studio, Josh.
My pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.